Thanks for joining us on WPR News Today. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And in case you're thinking that music sounded familiar, well, we're going to be talking about the book Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. And Michael Klassen is the author of the book and our guest today. Michael has been writing and photographing Northern Michigan for newspapers and magazines for 40 years, creating feature articles about the life and culture of Michigan's North Country. He's founder of the UP Reader and is a member of the board of directors for the Upper Peninsula Publishers and Authors Association. And in 2020, Michael won the Historical Society of Michigan's George Follow Award for Upper Peninsula History. What are your questions about pirates and the history of the Great Lakes? Well, I'd love to hear from you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michael, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
You bet. So I'm assuming you're with us from Upper Michigan. I hear you live in the Sioux.
I do. It's a wonderful place to be, and it's also just full of history on its own.
It certainly is. Now, how long have you been up in the UP?
Since about 1979.
Oh, so for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. And decided not to go home.
I'm sorry, you dropped out for that first part of your sentence there. You said...
I came up here to go to school at Northern Michigan University and decided never to go home. So.
I don't think you're alone in that, are you?
Oh, no, not a bit.
Now, Piracy on the Great Lakes is one of several books that you've written about the history in the UP. Why don't you kind of give us an overview of the history of the region?
Well, there's plenty, plenty of history like there is throughout most of our Great Lakes, going back to the days of the voyageurs in the mid to late 1600s, all the way up through now. It was full of people were searching for copper, were searching for furs, were searching for anything they could find. Of course, we also had the logging industry. One of the more unique things about living in the Great Lakes itself is that we have a very, very unique culture here in that not only do we have the miners and the loggers, we also have the maritime culture that goes along with it, which makes our Great Lakes history unique in that fashion.
Is that one of the reasons why you decided to write the Piracy on the Great Lakes book?
Well, actually, that started out with State of Michigan asking me to do a lecture for their Upper Peninsula History Conference. They have one here every year for the State of Michigan Historical Society. And in one of my previous books called True Tales, The Forgotten History of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, I talk about a pirate in there that used to sail out of Escanaba. His name was Dan Seavey. And he was really quite well documented. And being who I am, I just am fascinated with pirates. Most people are. And to come across a pirate, I had discovered a folder in Marquette that had a thing called Great Lakes Legends on it, and I opened it up, and there's this pirate. So I ended up following it up. But the Historical Society of Michigan contacted me, asked me if I would do a lecture on Great Lakes pirates and piracy in the Great Lakes region that for a conference lecture, for about 45 minutes. And so when I did the lecture, it was standing room only. I didn't realize there was this much interest in the subject of pirates on the Great Lakes. So I sat down with my publisher and told him, how well it had gone, sent him a copy of the lecture that I had written up for the presentation. And we just decided to expand on it and put it into a book.
Well, I can see that. Why are we so fascinated with pirates? I mean, do you think part of it was just like we were so excited we had pirates that weren't from the Caribbean?
Well, that may be possibly part of it, but also I just think, you know, true crime on most levels at this point is extremely popular.
It is.
You know, we have people that are doing books on serial killers and all sorts of, you know, different types of criminal activities that take place in all of our states. I see books everywhere on, you know, basically true crime. And piracy was one that hadn't really been touched on. It's a subject that few people know about. Almost everybody is surprised when they learn that there were actually pirates sailing in the Great Lakes. And so it ends up being, I think, a discovery for people that really had no idea that anything like that existed.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I grew up in the UP. I went to school on the Garden Peninsula. I had no idea about this, the pirate CV. Never heard a thing about it. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, and he had a place at the Garden. He spent a lot of time there in that area, just like James Strang did south of there in the Beaver Islands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That region seemed to be very, very popular with pirates for some reason. I'm not really sure what it was, but that one seemed to have that area of the Great Lakes seems to have had more than its share of that kind of activity.
Right. Now, when we say pirates, what does a pirate on the Great Lakes look like?
Well, he looks like pretty much everybody else. There was none of this, you know, like fancy dresses that we see, you know, we associate with the Pirates of the Caribbean and things like that. These were just renegade sailors and captains that went out and stole stuff. And they stole pretty much everything that wasn't tied down and some that was. They were all over the place. One of the big reasons is because of the fact that the USS Michigan was the only law on the maritime waters. So wherever the Michigan was, not much was going on, but as soon as they moved into another lake, it opened up everything else. They were patrolling from, you know, they were patrolling Lake Erie, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, and after the Sioux Locks were put in, Lake Superior. And so for that to be the only type of law on the water, piracy was very, very easy to do. You just go pick something off from some dock or raid a ship or whatever, and then go a few ports over and resell it.
Right. I mean, how simple is that, really? You've got one ship on all of the lakes, and so you just need to know where that ship is, and it's open, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. Absolutely. It wasn't until the latter part of the 19th century, you know, right around 1900, that we really started getting large amounts of interdiction on the water because of eventually bringing in or creating the Coast Guard, which we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And once the Coast Guard was created, then it started becoming more difficult, although, admittedly, people like Seavey still, he didn't care. He just went all around the lakes anyway and would just outrace them. So there are quite a few there were quite a few different things going on at the time that eventually put an end to all of it.
Sure.
But,
now, you had mentioned that you had found out about one of the pirates kind of by accident doing some research. I can't believe it was easy to find these pirates that you talk about in your book. What was that research like?
Well, certainly it wasn't easy to find. I've been researching Dan Seavey since the 1980s. So it's been a lot of years of digging into his history and you're right, there isn't a lot of it that's, you know, easy to find out there. That's one of the things about the piracy, of course, is you know you don't want to get caught, so you try to keep it secret. And so a lot of this isn't known, you know, certain activities that were going on. But finding specific individuals is extremely hard. You know, we only have, I think, about half a dozen or so that we really, really know as individual characters that we can look at as, you know, he was the captain, he was leader of the group, that kind of thing. We know there were things, you know, going on like timber pirates would go into places and just steal logs, as many as they could take. They'd steal the lumber and run off with it. And it was a monster problem. The big thing with it is, though, that the settlers and stuff at the time, this was in the 1800s, the settlers at the time hated the trees. They wanted them gone, so they actually were out on the side of the pirates. So consequently, if the pirates were captured or anything like that, some of the locals would rise up and let them loose.
And the reason they wanted the logs gone is because they wanted to farm, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be like that all through, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, all those areas wanted it cleared. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it was certainly started out as, you know, for homesteading and farming and that sort of thing. But of course, it became, you know, communities and things like that. If you look at old photographs, historical photographs, most of the communities you look at back then, there are no trees left.
Yeah, clear cut.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That was one of the things that they, you know, would go after. Of course, you know, with the fur traders, there was fur trade pirates where they would, you know, raid each other's canoes and steal the furs because they were gold.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were worth a heck of a lot of money. The canoes could carry up to, depending on the size of the canoe, some of them were 35 feet long, some of them were 60 feet long and would have, you know, like 15 voyageurs paddling the one canoe, and it would be packed as hard as it could be with furs. And if you, you know, stole a couple of those, you had a lot of money in furs, and there was a war going on between the Northwest Fur Company and Hudson Bay Company over furs and territory and that sort of thing. So they, which even led to a couple of massacres that went on just over the furs, so you could steal from one and sell it to the other.
We are speaking with Michael Klassen. He's author of Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. Do you have any questions for him? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. At noon today, we're going to hear about the story of Greendale, the planned city near Milwaukee. And then at 12:30, we'll talk with the editor of Lake Superior Magazine. Right now, we are talking about Pirates on the Great Lakes. Michael, why don't you tell me a little bit about what the average ship that sailed the Great Lakes looked like? And we talked a little bit about some of the cargo, furs earlier. Logs. What else? What other kinds of things were they hauling around?
Well, as I said, kind of mentioned earlier, they would take just about any kind of commodity that they could resell somewhere else. It really didn't matter what it was. They would steal cargo from one place to another, just depending on what they got. But it was all about commodities. Most of the earlier pirates, of course, were on sailing ships. Dan Seavey, the pirate that was based in Escanaba, he would preferred schooners. He didn't like motorized ships. He felt they were faster and easier to maneuver, and he could outrun a lot of the steam-powered vessels, and as long as the wind was fair, he was good. And he ended up having, I think, by the time he was done, four or five different ships, but they were all schooners. When James Strang, the Mormon pirate, he had three sailing ships. They would have been three-masted schooners as well. And so they were definitely out there on their sailing. Early on, of course, the fur trade ships, those, as well as the Thousand Islands, Will Johnson, who was that was at the Thousand Islands near New York. He used all the islands as places to hide out and that sort of thing. And they were using sneak up on ships and board them in the night. And then they would go out and escape back into the islands, and nobody could find them. He also claimed to be a privateer working as a Canadian revolutionary against the Canadian government at the time. And so he was able to confuse the legal system enough that they weren't able to prosecute him. They tried to prosecute him on the American side, but because he had written up this document, he himself had written the document that he was commander of the revolutionary forces and that he had every right to be doing what he was doing. And though he really didn't, the Canadians really wanted him. And eventually they would try to go after him, but he would never get caught. He eventually...
Oh, I think we're having... Michael, we're having a lot of problems with your cell phone. Maybe we could reconnect. We'll take a little short break and see if we can maybe reconnect so we don't miss all of your cool information. So let's just take a little bit of break right now. If you've got a question for our Michael, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Hi, this is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, and tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about biofuels. We're also going to look at a shipwreck that they found in the Fox River, and then we're going to look at centipedes. So please join us. Larry will be back from vacation, so I'm sure he'll be all fresh and willing to talk. Right now, we are looking at piracy on the Great Lakes. We're looking at a book by Michael Klassen. It's called Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. And Michael, hopefully we got a better connection with you now.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And that's one of the problems of living in the Upper Peninsula.
Our
connections for literally everything are not very good.
I think if someone really wanted to make a lot of money, they would be able to, if they could provide that up there, yeah, they would be a very rich person. So,
yeah, they could do well. There's no doubt of that.
Yes, they could. So, let's start talking about some of the actual pirates themselves. Okay, we had talked about a few, but let's start out with one that's for Wisconsin, the Apostle Islands. Tell us about the little bit that you dug up on that.
Yeah, that was kind of a surprise for me. I came across this story, and it's only, right, as I mentioned in the book, it's only, I've only been able to find one source for this, but it was from the Bayfield, Wisconsin.
Okay, that was even worse. we just dropped you again. I am so sorry. It sounded so good for a while. So you said that you found it from the Bayfield...
Historical Society,
okay.
And it was basically a newspaper clipping about this group of pirates that used to sail out of the Apostle Islands that called themselves the Apostles, and they literally had named themselves Mark, Luke, John, after all of the Apostles. The one who was leading themselves called himself Chief. I don't know. Apparently, he didn't want to be called Jesus
for various reasons.
Yeah, well, they were out raiding the French at the time. This is really early on during the fur days, and they were raiding long rowboats, and they ended up robbing a payroll from the French, which gave them enough incentive to go after them. They eventually got them, hauled them away, hung them all. But supposedly, according to the article I had read, that is because of these apostle pirates. That's where the name of the Apostle Islands comes from. Now, yeah. I'm not sure if that's true, because, like I say, I only found one source for this. But it does make sense. The only other ones that would have done something like that would have been the Jesuits, though they, you know, certainly had a heavy, heavy presence along Lake Superior and that area back in those days.
Sure. It's not like there's just 12 islands. So, I mean, that really does make sense.
Yeah.
Let's go to John in Menominee, Michigan. He's got a comment. Go ahead, John.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate the work that your author is doing, but not every pirate, or I'd say maybe nautical thief, was on ships. There were wreckers in the along the East Coast, and I was just wondering if any of that activity had spread to the Great Lakes.
Oh, yeah, wreckers were actually quite common. It was one of the things that the Mormons really liked to do, from Jesse Strang at the Beaver Island Pirates. He actually was a senator for a while in the state of Michigan, and was able to get lighthouses in at the Beaver Islands. And so then the pirates would use fake lights, shut off the lighthouses, and wreck ships there at the Beaver Islands, and then, of course, steal from the wreckage. But Dan Seavey would also use wrecking tactics, where you put a fake light on a barrel where they were supposed to, you know, put out the light of the real one, and then have them run aground. They were also called moon cussers because of the fact that they did it in the dark of the moon when you couldn't see anything. That way you wouldn't get a glimpse or something of the actual lighthouse or whatever. So they tried to do it on, you know, darker, stormy nights, and then it would make it harder for them to see.
Okay, thank you, John. I really appreciate the call. If you have a question for Michael, give us a call too, 800-642-1234. Now let's dive into James Jesse Strang. Very unusual man. Great beginning. So tell us the tale.
Well, one of the things about Strang is when you read most books about him, they spend most of their time talking about the Mormonism and the Mormon side and him declaring himself King of the Mormons and his split up between Brigham Young and himself after Joseph Smith, the head of the Mormons, died. They ended up splitting off, and James Strang decided to move all of his disciples, basically, to the Beaver Islands, and he claimed to have had a vision from God that all of the islands were the Mormons and that it was their land. And so that also gave them the right to take anything they wanted to off from, quote, their land, you know,
right?
Which it really wasn't. But they would go and they would raid all the little islands and settlements along, like particularly northern Lake Michigan, on both sides, Wisconsin, Michigan, north the lower and upper peninsula. They would raid these places and claim that that was all theirs to start with. And they would take livestock. They would take anything that they wanted to, if they needed equipment. They'd even steal ships, whatever they could come across. So eventually, Strang would start using, he would get away from monogamy and started getting into the polygamy. And he had always claimed not to have, wasn't going to do that. Eventually, he did, which started alienating a lot of his followers, as well as if you weren't going along with the Mormon laws and rules, you could be publicly flogged, which they would take a big birch branch and just whip the crap out of somebody as a punishment for not adhering to the Mormon doctrines that they had established on the islands there. And so consequently, he made a lot of enemies within his own followers and would eventually be assassinated by two of his own followers. There's always been a controversy as whether the USS Michigan was actually involved in that, because they happened to be there at the time when the assassination took place. Strang had become pirates and the Mormonism and raiding the villages and stuff that they wanted him gone. Not just his own people, but everybody who was in the region really wanted him gone. When he was shot, there was a whole bunch of locals that get from like Mackinac Island and Charlevoix and those areas gathered together on a little place called St. Helena Island, which is near where the Mackinac Bridge is now. They got a group together and in one night drove all the Mormons out of the Beaver Islands and just either dropped them off somewhere or would take them to different places to get rid of them. Some of them were beaten. It was a night of terror, considered one of the ugliest evenings in Michigan history.
Wow, that is, you know, that's amazing, and I have never heard of that before, and I don't think a lot of people have. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I do, particularly about the fact that he was doing the piracy, because like I said, things written on him tend to really focus on the Mormonism side and don't talk much about the fact that he also had this pirate fleet that he was out raiding all these different places, and it tends to kind of get lost in the biographies, which is kind of sad, because it was a really, in my opinion, a big portion of what he did there. You
know? Right. Now, tell us a little bit about how the Great Lakes came into play during the Civil War.
Yeah, that one was kind of funny. I had to laugh through that. In the Civil War, there was an island in Lake Erie called Johnson's Island. That was a prisoner of war camp for the South, or, you know, it was the North, but I mean, they were housing Southern rebels there. It started out as officers and whatnot from the, captured from the Civil War. And over time, they kept placing more and more people on this island in Lake Erie. So as the Civil War wore on, the South started plotting ideas through Canada of raiding Johnson's Island and releasing all these prisoners into the northern border of the United States and have them, you know, creating havoc and whatnot as they worked their way back to the South. And they were going to hijack the USS Michigan for this purpose. And so they started out doing that, and the hierarchy at the Civil War, Jefferson Davis and his war cabinet, decided not to go through with the first attempt, but the idea stayed out there. And they ended up they got a guy be the crew of the USS Michigan, and he was going to get the USS Michigan drunk or drugged. They weren't really sure which. And then take, you know, basically have a ship come up alongside and take over the USS Michigan. They'd be able to go release all these prisoners. Well, the guy that was on board basically underestimated the crew's ability to drink.
Never do that with a sailor.
Yeah, never do that with a sailor. There's reasons there's songs about that. What do you do with a drunken sailor? But it didn't work. They eventually grabbed him. He was thrown in the brig, the boat, as they were, he was supposed to give a signal to the boat that was supposed to come alongside. And, of course, he never did. So they figured it out and ran. And eventually, they would end up abandoning the boat and the whole plot would go out. But they tried this four different times.
Right.
And were never able to make it work. They have to be the most inept pirates I've ever read about in my entire life.
And you do end that chapter with that particular line. So
I do, yeah. It really is. It's
Now, speaking of the Civil War, there also are rumors about actual lost gold. So there is some of that in the Great Lakes. Why don't you tell us about that one?
Well, one of the things that, you know, tends to follow pirates is treasure. And most of the pirates on the Great Lakes had nothing like that. They were stealing commodities. They weren't stealing gold or things like that. But there were certain plots where they were attempting to bring gold through into the Great Lakes and then down the Illinois into the Mississippi, where they could get around the southern lines and the battles and help resupply with money the soldiers and or the war effort. And supposedly a shipment of that gold came from France and eventually didn't make it. It's one of the larger treasure stories out there, is the treasure of Poverty Island, which is, again, off of the Garden Peninsula, and that the ship that was carrying that gold sunk somewhere around Poverty Island. So treasure hunters have spent years and tons of different expeditions trying to find this supposed lost gold that came from France to help supply the Civil War. Now, it was also said that there was a treasure, strangely enough, on a place called Oak Island, that in the Apostle Islands from the Apostle Pirates that no one has ever found, of course, either. So there are some stories of pirate treasure, but most of them didn't. Like Dan Seavey never would have. He just raided stuff and sold it.
Right.
And that was, you know, and the same thing with Strang. All the stuff that he was raiding, he was bringing back to the community there at Beaver Island. So there really wasn't a treasure involved with that. But there is a lot of stories of when they ran the Mormons out, that the Mormons were run out so fast that they left a lot of things behind, and including money, belongings, all that kind of thing. So there's a possibility you might find a little something on Beaver Island, but it's really hard to say. And there's certainly nothing there that's specific stories about any, like, Mormon treasure or things like that. So,
well, it's always fun to think about it, though.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. Yes. You know, there was a guy who spent his life up at a place called Little Girls Point on Lake Superior. It's right on the Wisconsin, Michigan border. And he had always heard that there was a story of lost treasure there. And he spent his entire life digging holes all around Little Girls Point, looking for some type of Civil War treasure that he had heard was there. And I'm not even sure where he heard it all from, but he never found it. And, you know, that was his entire life, searching for that one little treasure out there. So,
and some of these pits were 80 to 100 feet deep that he was digging.
Yeah. I think he was looking. I think he was looking for more than just a lost box of treasure. When you get that deep, you start to look for more. And certainly, in that area, there, a Little Girl's Point, mm-hmm. is right between a lot of the copper deposits, and with copper comes silver,
sure.
and gold under the same types of processes. So there are times when you can find them all together, but he never found anything.
Mm-hmm.
Out there. So it was just a lifetime of digging holes.
So we talked about the timber that pirates went out of, but how did the was it the Timber Rebellion of 1853 play into that?
Well, that was finally things coming to a head. The USS Michigan and the federal government finally got somebody who was willing to go out there and try and put a stop to all this timber theft on federal lands, which, of course, were much more substantial than they are today. They were trying to put a stop to it, and they finally got a somebody who would do it, but with the aid of the USS Michigan. And when they would try to prosecute the pirates, a lot of the locals weren't willing to go along with it. Those timber pirates were basically their heroes, cleaning out all the timber. And so eventually things got heated enough that one of the ships rammed the USS Michigan, put a good-sized dent in it. But the USS Michigan was also an ironclad. It was the only one on the Great Lakes. And so when the wooden schooner hit the USS Michigan, they didn't sink it. It, you know, caused quite a lot of damage. And for a while, the captain actually thought it was an accident. But over time, they figured out that it was probably just put the mission out of commission. A few days repaired, and it was back out on the water. But eventually, they would start arresting and prosecuting a lot of these timber pirates, and would put an end to it. But it went on. The bigger parts of it were down near southern Lake Michigan, which is where a lot of the activities was taking place, and the rebellion was taking place down there. On both sides of the border, you know, between sure. Wisconsin and Michigan.
Now, one of the pirates that kind of is more prominent during that time is Bully Hayes. What was his life like?
Well, he was an interesting character. He started out in the Great Lakes. He was in Cleveland and started out raiding ships on Lake Erie. And eventually it would become too hot for him there. So he actually sailed to the South Seas and became a South Seas pirate, and a very, very famous one, and to the point where they were even doing pulp fiction novels about him. Pulp fiction was really popular back in around the turn of the century, of course, you know, coming out of the dime novels out of the West. Well, they'd find any type of rip-roaring, snorting type of person that they could write a story about, and Bully Hayes became one of them. And there were, like I say, several comic books, or not comic books, dime novels that featured him. So he rose a lot higher in prominence than an awful lot of the pirates coming out of the Great Lakes, just simply because of his adventures in the South Seas. There was very, very little to locate about him operating here, and when you try to search him out in the South Seas, it's really hard to separate fact from fiction.
Mm. Well, the pirates kind of wanted that, didn't they? They wanted that fear from people.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. They would want that, as well as, of course, you know, these exploits weren't something that they could prosecute them for, because basically they were fiction.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, you would end up letting that go. You know, for the most part, what he did here in Cleveland or whatnot was essentially what everybody else was doing, was just, you know, hit a boat, steal everything that was on it, and then resell it somewhere else on the other end of the lake. And it would go quite well like that. So
now, you've mentioned Dan Seavey a few times. Where he grew up in Maine. How did he get to the Great Lakes?
A lot of people came to the Great Lakes as far as migrating to this area because of work and different things. It was also a place you could go where you could be reasonably anonymous for the most part. I think that's a lot of it. But he originally came, you know, I think moved here through just normal migration, looking to the west and to the frontier like so many did. A lot of people don't realize that this area, Wisconsin, you know, to the Mississippi River and Michigan, were all considered the Northwest Territory. This was the West before the West. And so consequently, it was open country to do pretty much whatever you wanted. You know, there was a lot of illegal things going on. Frequently, the sheriffs and prosecutors, judges, were all involved in illegal activities and that sort of thing. So it wasn't that hard to operate under the radar in these regions, as well as, you know, if you're greasing the right palm, you pretty much wouldn't have much to worry about. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well. A lot of my historic research over the years have really brought home how rugged and ruthless this region really was.
Yeah, and you say, I mean, ruthless, it's, you know, fun to talk about pirates, but a lot of the time they boarded the ships and threw the people that were there off and killed them. So it wasn't like this was a, you know, there was no person who was hurt by this, right?
Well, yeah, except the guys that got thrown overboard.
Yeah.
They, you know, no witnesses are the best witnesses.
Right.
They don't testify in court,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's one of the reasons why I say a lot of our piracy stories are lost because, you know, you don't want people to know about this. You know?
Right, right.
You know, you're committing the worst crimes possible, you know, through murder and mayhem and all this, you know, these other things that go along hand in hand with piracy. So it's it turned out to be, you know, it's they were just as rough and ready as anybody else out there, and certainly without any law on the water, they weren't going to get caught anytime soon. You just, as long as you don't know, as long as the story stays quiet, that's you're good to go.
That's right. We got an email from Chris in Sturgeon Bay. She's wondering if you know of any piracy occurring during Prohibition, and you do have something like that in your book.
I do. Yeah, there was a lot of it. Prohibition was a really ripe time for any kind of thief out there on the water. I came across this character called the Great Ghost, which basically he wore gray and a mask and all this on a boat and ran between Detroit and Windsor and all up and down the Detroit River. A lot of people don't realize it, but there was so much booze being moved across the Detroit River because Canada did not make it illegal. As a matter of fact, they actually encouraged the sales. They would have all sorts of different kinds of booze lined up on the docks for everybody to come over and grab all you want and take it to the U.S. And so consequently, with these runs, if you happen to stop a boat going across, well, they had all this money to buy the booze with. If you caught them when you were coming back from over there, they would have a cargo load of booze that you could resell. So consequently, if you were pirating these guys, which they were, they were easy marks. They're either carrying cash or commodities, and you know, people don't realize, but in 1 year, just across the section of the Detroit River, between Lake Huron and Lake Erie, just in that little bit, there was $212 million worth of booze moved across in the 1930s in 1 year.
Yeah, fortunes were made, weren't they? And what are you going to do? You can't complain to the authorities because what you're doing is illegal. So
right,
mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's free and open and pretty much lawless.
Right.
And again, you know, at least, you know, during Prohibition, there were there was police on the water and things like that that were trying to catch this, but, you know, it was really, really tough. When I did the gray ghost thing, the one of the most difficult things to deal with that was there was more than one of them. There was one that was in Detroit, there was one on the East Coast, and there was one on the West Coast, all called the gray ghost. So sorting that out was interesting because, of course, you know, those in many of the articles and stuff, they were getting mixed up.
Sure.
So,
yeah, I was just flabbergasted that he painted his guns, his pistols gray. He dressed in gray, like a gray trench coat. And this is like right out of the movies.
It is. I know. When I found the character, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking, oh, God, this really is. Yeah, it's like something out of a 1930s pulp novel.
Totally. You know? It certainly is. It certainly is. So how did who or what put an end to the pirates on the Great Lakes?
Mostly the law. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we still have, things coming across the Great Lakes. And it's, you know, people still smuggle things and whatnot. It's not like what it was in the old days. But, you still occasionally have people doing stuff like that. But mostly the end of Prohibition kind of put an end to all of it. It, there was the mobs moved into things like heroin and opium and, you know, stuff like that once the booze became legal again, and which was not a commodity that was coming through the Great Lakes. That would be something that was going to be shipped in, you know, through the West Coast or the East Coast or, you know, that sort of thing. So we don't really see as much of it as we did then. And the Great Lakes kind of at this point, because we're so isolated here between Canada and the U.S., that you don't see much of that coming across the Canadian border anymore. But certainly you do see it coming across the waters, the oceans and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, in my opinion, Prohibition pretty much was the end of the piracy within the Great Lakes itself.
Sure. I guess that makes sense. Now, you've written a number of books and articles about the UP. Do you have something that you're working on right now?
Yeah, I have several things I'm working on. I'm, I have a book that did really well called True Tales, The Forgotten History of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and I'm just finishing off a second one of UP history. And so instead of like trying to write a history of the UP, I've just picked up little bits and pieces here and there, just some of the wilder and crazier stories that are up here. There used to be women's stockades that were up here that were prisons for women that were kidnapped off from farms in Wisconsin, Ohio, Illinois. And they were brought up here and tortured into being prostitutes for loggers and stuff like that in these isolated places all through the wilderness and woods up here. And they were called stockades. And they were all over the place from Minnesota all the way to the eastern UP and lower Michigan. So,
wow. That's definitely something that is not out there readily. So,
no, it actually surprised a lot of the communities that I was doing this with, too. So,
yeah, for sure. Well, we want to thank you, Michael, for being with us today. When that next book comes out, let us know, and maybe we can have you back to talk about that, too.
Well, that sounds good.
All right.
Always happy to do these kinds of things, and thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. We've been talking with Michael Klassen. He's the author of Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. Stay with us because we're going to talk about Greendale. It's a planned city. Have you heard of planned cities? Well, stick with us and you'll learn all about it.